Our speaker today is Diane Fields. Diane is a member of Socialist Alternative and has been involved in organising, you know, all kinds of different activism and socialist politics, promoting socialist politics. She's based up in Sydney. She'll be introducing the talk on workers' power and the German Revolution. Then after that, we'll have the discussion. Please welcome Diane.
People often talk about the German Revolution as the lost revolution, and I think it's just a truism that defeated revolutions are soon forgotten. It's not like the people who rule our world want to celebrate workers' revolutions in general, but when they can put them aside and forget about them because, well, that never really even happened, then that's obviously preferable. And so 100 years later, this year is the 100th anniversary of the German Revolution breaking out. I think it's even more so. So a bit of audience participation. Who has heard of the Russian Revolution? Put your hand up. Pretty much everyone, okay. Who has heard of the German Revolution, at least prior to coming to this talk? Oh, more than I expected.
That's good.
Good. Okay, well, you know, the ruling class hasn't got it all their own way. So I want to say a few things about the significance. What I'm going to try and do is just tell you a bit about the importance of the German Revolution and a few of its major features. So in terms of its significance, I think that firstly, it shows us the possibility of something that matters a great deal in a country like Australia, the possibility of workers' revolution in a developed Western country. Germany was the world's second industrial power at the end of World War I, and therefore what happened there was not only bound to have an effect 100 years later on people like us, but to have a major effect on the whole of Europe at the time. Secondly, in terms of its significance, a successful workers' revolution in Germany would have had a decisive effect on whether the workers' state in Russia was able to survive. The Bolsheviks always recognised that their only hope of the workers' revolution in Russia surviving was to spread the revolution to the more advanced economies of Western Europe. And so in November 1918, the overthrow of the German Kaiser seemed to signal the beginning of the same process that had begun in February of 1917 with the overthrow of the Russian Tsar and ended, of course, in October that year with the Socialist Revolution. But it was not to be. Despite huge battles, the revolution was defeated in Germany over the course of the years 1919 to 1923. And it was this isolation of workers' power to a single country, to Russia, that sealed the fate of the Russian Revolution. I think there's a session in this stream later on about what happened to the Russian Revolution, the rise of Stalinism and so on. Suffice it to say here that the isolation of workers' power to that single country of Russia sealed the fate of the revolution. Its isolation ensured its defeat and the rise of Stalinism. But there was nothing automatic about all of this. And so I want to frame this introduction to the German Revolution with something that with which I think you're all much more familiar than the German Revolution, and that's World War I. So the outbreak of World War I was decisive in the political events that followed. The outbreak of war threw the international socialist movement into crisis, and nowhere more so than in the German Social Democratic Party, which I'll call from now on by its initials, the SPD. But socialist leaders from country after country, in most socialist parties, their leaders flocked to support their country, so-called, their country's war effort, and they took, in the case of Germany and elsewhere, they took masses of their party members with them. That's the beginning of World War I. But also, there's the end, and that's incredibly important. How did World War I end? Common sense, the things you learn at school would have it that some important people got together at the Treaty of Versailles and sorted things out, and that was it. The people that took us to slaughter apparently could end that slaughter if they felt like it. But actually, the real story is that the workers' revolution in Germany ended World War I. And I think that shift in what the attitude to the war and so on between 1914 and 1918 shows us something else. It shows what an impact revolutionary leadership can have. The importance of the stance of the anti-war revolutionary socialists, those who stood against the leaders of the SPD from the outset, who never gave in to the nationalist fervour when all around them were doing so, and their role in that transformation from pro-war 1914 to workers' action ends the war in 1918 is incredibly important, especially for those of us who want to play that kind of role in the here and now and in the future. So I'm not only going to give an account of the inspiring struggles, I'm not going to go all the way through to 1923, I'm just going to focus on the period 1918 to 1919. I don't want to just give an account of the inspiring struggles, but also something very fundamental, why revolutionary politics and organisation matters. And I make no apology for that. That's the business that Socialist Alternative is in. We want to build a revolutionary organisation. We want to be a serious organisation that can play a role in whatever struggles arise now, but also in the future. And so the argument of the German Revolution is also an argument of why revolutionary politics and organisation matters, not just at the time of revolution, but beforehand. OK, so let's move on to the politics of the SPD and World War I. We're saying that before World War I, the SPD was the largest socialist party in the world. It was enormous. It's hard to imagine. This was a party that called itself revolutionary Marxist in its programme. It didn't sort of present itself like the Labour Party or something. It had grown up in a period of boom and a period significantly accompanied by relatively little class struggle. From the 1880s right up to the war, strikes were relatively uncommon, and workers' living standards were still rising, even if they didn't keep pace with profits. The party's numbers grew steadily, reaching over a million members. A million members in 1914. And in the 1912 elections, they succeeded in getting 110 deputies, MPs, to the National Assembly. In addition, they had 3,000 other elected officials in lower elected bodies like councils and so on. They maintained 90 daily newspapers. Think about that. 90 daily newspapers. They employed 267 full-time journalists, 3,000 manual and clerical workers, and they led trade unions totalling 2 million members. This is a significant organisation. As I said, they labelled themselves revolutionary Marxist in their programme, but it's worth saying, right from back into the 19th century, this question of reform versus revolution was debated inside the party. And those debates produced some very important writing. Rosa Luxemburg, one of the great heroes of the workers' revolutionary struggle in Germany, interestingly enough, a foreigner and a Jewish woman, and yet she was a leader of the working class movement. She wrote a little book called Reform or Revolution in response to this debate about how should we try and change the world. And she argued that the choice between reform and revolution was false, that reformists who abandoned revolution as the means to socialism were not only choosing a different path, but an entirely different endpoint, a different goal, because the capitalists would never relinquish political power peacefully. Revolutionaries, on the other hand, did not renounce the system, the struggle for reforms. Revolutionaries are always the best fighters for reforms within the context of the capitalist system. Rather, the revolutionaries argued that reforms could only go so far and would inevitably be able to be rolled back as long as the motive ruled, and therefore revolution was also necessary. The struggle for reform was part of the struggle of every revolutionary, but it was not enough. Now, Luxemburg actually won the vote in the SPD around this question of reform versus revolution, but I'm sorry to say this did not check the spread of reformist ideas, and this was made very clear when World War I broke out. Like most socialist parties internationally, the SPD abandoned internationalism and fell in behind its own ruling class. It voted for war credits, that is, to fund the war, in direct violation of its policy commitment to an unrelenting struggle against imperialist war. As one of the great historians, Pierre Brueux, of the German Revolution, he says this: their words were exposed as a paltry rhetorical cover for a reality that consisted of shrapnel, bombs, machine guns, poison gas and imperialist aims. The Socialist International died on August the 4th. But sadly, in its death throes, it took most of its working class supporters with it, at least initially. So the obvious question is, well, how could this happen? In the decade or so leading up to the war, I have to say that a sterile reformist approach had increasingly come to dominate the day-to-day practice of the SPD. The leaders made their peace with the capitalists in exchange for a few crumbs from the tables of the rich, a few seats at the parliamentary table and so on. And the extent of the reformist degeneration of parties like the SPD was really most starkly revealed, obviously, at the outbreak of the war. But within the party, there was a revolutionary minority on the left who did not capitulate. And centrally, Rosa Luxemburg, who I mentioned before, and Karl Liebknecht. I suspect some of you might have been in the wonderful talk that Rebecca Baragos did yesterday about who killed Karl Liebknecht, but insofar as you know any names of the people who played a key role in the German Revolution, it's Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, I think, whose names should stand out. We'll come back to them. And yet, when the SPD capitulated in favour of war, these leading figures were left virtually alone, unable to change the course of events. They tried within the SPD, because they were inside it, to express their dissent, but the SPD leadership, working arm in arm with the German police, used every method to stifle their dissidents, censoring newspapers, banning political meetings. And by December 1914, only a few months after the war had broken out, Karl Liebknecht decided he was a member of parliament for the SPD. He decided that loyal opposition within the SPD was impossible, and he voted alone in the parliament against the war credits that the SPD supported. And in this way, he made himself the symbol of the anti-war opposition and the rallying centre of its scattered forces. For his defiance, he was punished. He was drafted and sent to the front. He was in his 40s at this stage. But anti-war sentiment grew. The revolutionaries who stood firm were not isolated for that long, because before long, the war itself meant that the pro-war consensus began to fray. The end of 1915, there were anti-war demonstrations in Berlin. More and more workers were being conscripted to pointless death or appalling injuries. On the home front, drastic rationing had been introduced. Food was in short supply. In Germany, there was what was famously known as the turnip winter. Everything was made out of turnips. For those coffee lovers amongst you, there was turnip coffee. Just disgraceful. So workers were forced to work longer and longer hours in increasingly unsafe conditions to meet the needs of the war effort. Wages have been slashed to the bone, basic working conditions undermined, and so on. And to control dissent, harsh censorship had been imposed, core democratic rights had been removed, and socialist and other opponents of the war were jailed. Not only was Liebknecht drafted and sent to the front, obviously in the hope he'd be killed, but Rosa Luxemburg spent months in jail during the war as well. In fact, in 1915, she wrote a marvellous pamphlet called the Junius Pamphlet while she was in prison, and in it she called for strikes to end the war. She laid the blame for the war squarely on the German authorities. The pamphlet had to be distributed underground as both the police and the SPD leadership sought to suppress it. But the pamphlet found a growing hearing, and on May Day 1916, workers demonstrated in Berlin against the war. So by the middle of 1916, it became obvious that the SPD was headed for a split. On the right, SPD leaders, whose names you will come to know, Noske, Scheidemann, Ebert, wholeheartedly supported the war. They enforced a no-strike pledge in the workplaces, and by 1915 they were openly endorsing the German government's plans to annex foreign policy and create a German empire. On the left, the revolutionaries championed mass strikes and mutinies to bring the war to an end. In between these two camps, wavering centrist leaders opposed mass action but favoured negotiations to end the war as soon as possible. Really stalwart, these ones. It was not until the start of 1917, though, when the anti-war socialists of all stripes had been expelled from the SPD. The initiative lay again with the right-wing leaders of the SPD. They'd taken the initiative to expel them, that finally a more left-wing but still muddled party was formed called the USPD, the Independent Social Democrats. I'll just call them the USPD. And within that, Luxemburg finally formed a revolutionary faction within the USPD, trying to bring the revolutionaries together in a kind of more organised way, called the Spartacus League. The growing discontent received a massive political boost with the October 1917 revolution in Russia. At last, somewhere, workers had stood up and said no, not just to war, but to the system that had created it. The Russian Revolution transformed world politics, and for the first time ever, the mass of workers took control of society and began democratically and collectively to do something that had never been done before, to reshape every aspect of life for the benefit of the great majority. They created a new form of mass democracy, workers' councils, to replace the pseudo-democracy of the capitalist order. The Bolsheviks, the Russian revolutionary leaders, immediately put out a call for peace. The revolution had ended the war as far as Russian workers were concerned. They wanted to spread that. Part of what they did, they revealed all the dirty secret treaties of the great powers. They argued for workers not to rely on the politicians and generals to end the war, but to rise up against the warmongers, the argument that Luxembourg and Liebknecht had already been making in Germany. Bolshevik activists started leafleting German soldiers on the Eastern Front. And there was a response. That inspiration then led to, on the 28th of January 1918, 400,000 German workers went on strike against the war, and they were joined the next day by 100,000 more. But the strike was repressed. The ending of the strike movement revealed a number of things about the reformist leaders. Abert put it very clearly. Some of them are quite revealing. He said, "I joined the strike committee with the clear intention of bringing the strike to a speedy end to prevent damage to the country." That's the kind of union leader you really want. Because to end the war really would take revolutionary action, not just strikes. And those strikes were brutally repressed, but the pressure continued to build. So 1918 was a continuation of the devastating economic hardship for German workers and the catastrophic killing of soldiers. The USPD, recently formed, grew by leaps and bounds at the expense of the SPD, and the left wing of the USPD became radicalised under the impact of the Russian Revolution. So the idea already by 1918, the idea of a Russian-type socialist revolution based on workers' councils had become very popular amongst millions of workers and soldiers. And in November 1918, sailors about to be sent out on a suicide mission just to improve the bargaining position of Germany when the war ended, refused to go. They mutinied in the town of Kiel, and they set in motion a rebellion in the army, followed by mass revolt in the working class. Workers launched a general strike, quickly leading to the overthrow of the Kaiser, the collapse of the German government, and the proclamation of the German Republic. And so one of the most important themes, I think, of understanding the German Revolution is just this. The World War was ended not by negotiations amongst the great and powerful, but by revolution from below, first in Russia and then in Germany. And then across Germany, all hell broke loose as far as the bosses were concerned. Workers' councils were formed in dozens of cities along the same lines as the Russian Soviets. Just one example, in Cologne, the council, which had equal numbers of workers' and soldiers' delegates on it, established subcommittees to organise all sorts of things that the old state had previously organised, to organise security, food, demobilisation of the army, the press, sanitation, transport. Members of the council also, because they didn't trust the old rulers, were appointed as supervisors over the mayor, but also over those who controlled the railways, the post and telegraph, the police, the courts, the National Bank and the Army Command. All of these now had to answer to people that they had spent their entire lives bossing around. And finally, on the 9th of November 1918, it was Berlin's turn. Berlin had sort of been a holdout of kind of monarchical authority through the revolution. Well, the revolution had only been a few days, but they'd held out for that. The Spartacus leader, Karl Liebknecht, issued a call for a revolutionary general strike, and suddenly the revolutionary slogans were being taken up by hundreds of thousands of workers. In desperation, the old regime handed over control to the reformist leader, Ebert, making him chancellor in an attempt to keep some control over the situation. They knew they had a loyal ally in the reformists. As they saw it, this is one of the old regime's spokespeople, the problem is to resist the Bolshevik revolution, which is rising, ever more threatening, and which means chaos. The imperial question is closely linked to that of Bolshevism, We must sacrifice the Kaiser to save the country. This has absolutely nothing to do with dogmatic republicanism. I don't think we actually care about the republic in any other sense. But it was too late to stop the revolution. On November 9, the masses flooded the streets and marched to the city centre of Berlin. When confronted with a crowd of angry workers outside the parliament, following the abdication of the Kaiser, Ebert's second in command had little choice but to declare the German Republic. The Kaiser was gone. 200 metres away, Liebknecht was declaring something much better. He was declaring the free German Socialist Republic. And he said, "The reign of capitalism, which has turned Europe into a swamp of blood, is over. Those of you who want the world revolution, raise your hands." Imagine that moment. Yeah. And thousands of hands went up. All the old monarchical symbols were torn down and replaced by red flags. The Internationale was sung in the street. Mass meetings passed resolutions removing the authority of the bosses and generals. The only bodies with any semblance of power at this point were the workers and soldiers' councils. Chris Harmon, whose excellent history, The Lost Revolution, I could not recommend more highly, sums it up like this. To the question, who ruled Germany, there was only one possible answer. The councils did. But, and it's an important but, they were certainly not organised into any ordered system for running the country on a new basis. The reformists could not ignore the power that lay with this mosaic of councils. They attempted to win control of the movement in order to destroy its power. Then there was the effect that the revolution had in Russia. In Russia, its revolution was besieged by civil war and famine. Workers greeted the news of the revolution in Germany with euphoria. The Bolsheviks, as I said, knew the only chance for their revolution to survive was for the revolution to spread. And an eyewitness said this. I think, again, it's a really moving account. Tens of thousands of workers, this is workers in Russia, burst into wild cheering. Never have I seen anything like it. Until late in the evening, workers and Red Army soldiers were filing past. The world revolution had come. The mass of people heard its iron tramp. Our isolation was over. But, tragically, it was not to last. Toppling the old order was not the same as beginning the new. To destroy the German Empire, spontaneous strikes and street fights were enough. To build a new socialist order, the majority of the working class had to be conscious of what they were building, and this was far from the case, at least at this early stage. This spontaneous upsurge meant that many workers were taking action for the first time in their lives. And despite the SPD's pro-war stance, many workers still looked to the SPD as their party. They did not yet differentiate one socialist party from another. Again, Chris Harmon says, "The masses do not abandon overnight the prejudices hammered into them over a lifetime. There is no easy path by which the hard lessons of experience that alone will change their views can be evaded." And so before long, the forces of the old state, with the encouragement of the SPD leaders, began to reassert control. Negotiations began in the back rooms of the parliament between the USPD and the SPD, which just tells you something about how left-wing, or not quite, the USPD was. They began to negotiate, the party leaders, about the formation of a workers' government based on the parties, not on the workers' councils. The SPD leadership, repelled by the very idea of revolution, was trying to turn the revolution into a parliamentary coalition. Their trade union leaders, but also army officers, rushed to back the workers' council, to pack the workers' councils with hand-picked loyalists in order to prevent them from establishing the kind of dual power that developed in Russia from February 1917. And here, organisation, discipline and so on was decisive. Sadly, it was all on the wrong side. The chaos of revolutionary events allowed the disciplined apparatus of the SPD to gain positions of power in the workers' councils out of all proportion to the political mood of the working class. The assembly of workers' and soldiers' delegates from the councils that the left had called for in order to push the revolution forward, in fact, was stacked with their opponents. And eventually, those undemocratically organised delegates voted to hand power, not keep it in their own hands, keep it in the hands of the workers' councils, but to hand that power to a new parliament whose power would stand in opposition to and replace the Workers' and Soldiers' Councils. Now, of course, the revolutionaries inside the USPD were not going along with this. Within the USPD, Luxembourg spoke on behalf of the Spartacus League in favour of building up the power of the Workers' Councils as a dual power, not taking it away, aiming to eventually replace the parliament and the capitalist state bureaucracy with a Russian-type system based directly on the Workers' Councils alone. The kind of things that I outlined that had taken place in Cologne, for example, that sort of organisation, but on a nationwide and systematic scale. But the USPD's mid-December conference showed that, as the war is now ending, the majority of the USPD leadership had had enough. They'd got the end of the war. Now they were opposed to a renewed wave of workers' struggles to usher in socialism. And so the USPD splintered. It splintered at the very moment when it was most important to pose an alternative to the SPD, and it left the revolutionaries without a party. The USPD majority decision to turn away from the workers' councils is what finally forced the revolutionary leaders, the Spartacus leaders like Luxembourg, to found their own party, the Communist Party of Germany, the KPD. But it was not founded until the first phase of the revolution was being brought forcibly to a close. When the KPD was finally formed on the 30th of December 1918, it was a party of only 3,000 members, a party that had no history of actually organising together, of trying to work out their political positions collectively, arguing, debating and so on. They were thrust into, and the other thing, they had very few links with the organised working class. The 3,000 were largely young, raw, very enthused, revolutionary young workers with very little traditions inside the organised working class. And yet this was the organisation formed in the fire of revolution that had to try to lead workers through the most tumultuous class struggle in German history. The younger radicalised workers who joined, I said, were raw, impatient for immediate revolution, and who can blame them given what they'd just seen? They risked, however, because of their newness, being drawn into premature and rash attempts to seize power when those around them were not yet ready to join them. For example, they voted to boycott the elections for the new parliament that had been called by the SPD and USPD. These elections were meant to take place in February 19. Why did they vote to boycott? Because they expected a new spontaneous revolution to break out at any minute, but it was not to be. Here I want to move on to say a little bit about reformism and the way in which reformism played probably the most directly counter-revolutionary role of any reformist organisation in history. Not content with just getting the new parliament to push aside the idea of workers' power, the SPD at the start of January 1919 staged a provocation. They sacked the police chief that had been elected by the workers' councils. In response, Karl Liebknecht and the revolutionary shop stewards, this is the same revolutionary shop stewards who only a few days before had refused to join the KPD because of all those ultra-left youth who were just going to, a bunch of hotheads who were going to lose their heads and ruin everything. Suddenly, Liebknecht and the revolutionary shop stewards launched a general strike in response to the sacking of the police chief. Not such a bad idea. And then Tolly lost their heads and called for this strike to organise the overthrow of the government. The revolutionary forces were in disarray and they were unable, even Luxembourg, who understood immediately, my God, Karl, what have you done, that they were unable to stop this premature and disorganised attempt to seize power. And the failed insurrection gave the right the opportunity to go on the offensive and to show their true colours. The reformist leaders of the SPD, who had appeared before the war in normal times to be in favour of moderation, gradual progress and so on, now turned out to be the most ruthless practitioners of counter-revolutionary violence. Faced with the collapse of the German army, the German ruling class had financed a paramilitary force of thousands of right-wing army officers. They were called the Freikorps. And while this force was small, there were 4,000 of them, it was disciplined, well-armed and politically committed to its goal of suppressing workers and smashing the revolutionary left. And how did the SPD relate to the Freikorps? The SPD ministers, especially Gustav Noske, helped bring this force into being, defended it, and deployed it to restore order throughout Germany in the months after November 1918. And tragically, Luxembourg and Liebknecht, the revolutionary left's most able leaders, were arrested and murdered by the Freikorps on the 15th of January 1919. Having seriously damaged the left, the Freikorps crushed the workers' councils across Germany. They attacked these basic organisations of working class power, regardless of whether they were controlled by the KPD or the SPD. Their point was not they'd done the job, they'd been in alliance with the SPD, but any kind of working class organisation was anathema to the Freikorps and they wanted to wipe them all out. They had no loyalty to the SPD. Despite their losses, the KPD and the revolutionary vanguard of the German working class were not finished by any means. It was not until the end of 1923 that capitalist rule in Germany was firmly re-stabilised. So, finally, what can we learn from this? First, the First World War confirmed that political ideas matter. Indeed, they can lead people to different sides of the barricades. The debate between reform versus revolution had real-life consequences, even if it was not completely obvious at the time. The attempts of centrists like Karl Kautsky to paper over these fights merely served to disorient the left and gain time for the right to consolidate its control of the party apparatus. So actually, political debates, clarity, and then working out where do we go from here, how do we organise around these ideas, have consequences, and World War I really showed that. Secondly, it shows us that the capitalists are very ingenious when it comes to patching up their system and making the working class pay. Reformists, whose commitment to social change is limited to the confines of capitalism, can play an immensely destructive role in their service. And thirdly, the power of the working class was very much exhibited here, both in ending the great slaughter of World War I, but also the power of the working class, the potential power seen in those workers' councils, the role that they played, the embryo, if you like, of workers' power and how society could have been run totally differently. And the final thing I want to talk about is just something about political organisation. Luxembourg and Liebknecht were political giants, there's no doubt about that. And yet, lacking a powerful political organisation with clear Marxist ideas based in the working class, they were constantly hamstrung. They could not effectively put their revolutionary principles into practice time and time again. The genuine revolutionaries in the SPD before the war, led by Rosa Luxemburg, had opposed the war from the start. But how did they organise around that opposition? Compare them to Lenin in Russia. Unlike Lenin, they did not split from the reformists and attempt to build a clearly revolutionary organisation. In fact, Luxemburg argued explicitly against Lenin. She argued that to break with the SPD, it was huge after all, remember those figures, that to break with the SPD would condemn the revolutionaries to irrelevance. She argued instead that the role of revolutionaries was to make political arguments rather than to organise the most militant class-conscious workers into an organisation that could lead a fight against nationalists and reformists in the labour movement, that is, to embody those political arguments in an organisation. And the consequences were enormous. As working class opinion began to turn against the war, there was no organisation in Germany that could provide a clear pole of attraction. Individuals, Liebknecht in particular, were that pole of attraction, but what did you do with that amorphous sentiment? The communist parties, by contrast, that Lenin argued for were to be sharply different from the old socialist parties that had become dominated by moderate trade union officials and parliamentarians. They were to be parties that were unequivocally committed to revolution and workers' power. And this approach represented a major advance and a sharp break with the past traditions and practices of the working class movement. Previously, in most countries, revolutionaries and reformists and all kinds of people in between had cohabited in the same party, and this was the approach that continued in Germany right up to the end of the war. But I have to say, we should be clear that what this approach meant. It only stifled and held back the revolutionaries who were under pressure to water down their politics, and even if they stood firm, this capturing of the revolutionaries within the mass reformist organisation only benefited the reformists. Workers needed to be offered a clear alternative between propping up the system and an all-out fight for human freedom, and the SPD was not the vehicle for that. And so it's not to say that building revolutionary parties is an easy task. It was something that had taken the Russian Marxists more than 20 years of struggle and the dress rehearsal of the 1905 revolution. But when the war broke out, Lenin in Russia had a principled organisation of revolutionaries, it had a critical mass, it was rooted in key workplaces, it had spoken out strongly against the war in a fairly united way, and it immediately began organising opposition in the factories and at the front to the war. Luxembourg, on the other hand, was censored by the right of her own party, was not permitted to publish anything, and she had no independent organisation or publication of her own to counter that. And so the final lesson is the necessity of building independent revolutionary organisations before the moment of revolutionary crisis, as the Bolsheviks had done, rather than attempting, heroically but wrongly still, attempting to build one from scratch in the heat of battle. And I think these lessons, both negative and positive, were learned at a very great cost in the German Revolution. And we can do those revolutionaries no better service, I think, than to learn from them.